Get your gear ready. This is a Sherpa's Guide to Innovation. Welcome to episode 27 of A Sherpa's Guide to Innovation, a podcast dedicated to guiding you along your innovation expedition. This is your host, Ben Tingey, and Jay Gerhardt is with me again in the studio. Welcome, Jay.
Hey, Ben.
In episode 23, Jay talked about his recent improv adventure at Second City in Chicago and started a conversation about the strong connection that he found between improv and innovation. And as promised, we are returning to this theme with a really exciting guest. Kanur Bahal joins us from Seattle. She's founder of MindHatch. Not only is MindHatch one of the coolest names for a company I've ever heard, but it's a creative consultancy that helps businesses and organizations achieve better results with creative methods. Kanur's LinkedIn profile header has an exciting equation slash description. Says design thinking plus organizational improv plus innovation facilitation. So with that, Kanur, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure and privilege to be here.
We're happy to have you. Ben, I came across Kanur on Medium and then on LinkedIn when I got back from Second City. I was doing some writing on Medium myself. I was just doing a lot of research and came across the website and her profile. And I think over the weekend, I emailed Gene Wright, our boss and fearless leader, and said, this is who I want to be when I grow up. It was pretty clear to me she would be a really good guest for this improv and innovation thread.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for joining us, Kanur. We're excited to talk with you. And throughout this episode, we'll learn about your work at the intersection of innovation and improv. But could you take a minute to give us the skinny on your company, MindHatch?
Yeah, I'd love to. Gosh, to the extent that it can be described in just 1 minute, you listed off the three things that I do. And I love that you described it as potentially additive as an equation. But I think what all three things that MindHatch does are really at the intersection of bringing innovation and creativity to business and to the workplace. So we do design thinking, we do what we call organizational improv and innovation facilitation, all in an effort to both make workplace cultures better, but then also just to make, you know, products and services better and bottom line results better as well.
That's great. And where can people find you?
Oh, gosh, good question. Well, I live in Seattle. So if you want to meet IRL, I'm in Seattle. And then you can also find us online, of course. So our website is www.mindhatchllc.com. We're on social media on Twitter at MindHatchLLC. We're also on Facebook, on Medium, as Jay mentioned, and also on LinkedIn. We're fairly active on LinkedIn as well. And I'm just reminded that the last time I gave my website address and I actually included the www in the front, I got made fun of by a friend for doing that. I guess I'm not old, but I guess it made me sound old that I did that. So
I think I would have done that. And I do encourage folks to, if you're familiar with Medium or you're not familiar with Medium, to look up her article. She's got some really well-written, concise articles on design thinking and improv, and it's really encourage everyone to do that.
Yeah, hear, hear. Kanur, you wear several hats, an innovator, improviser, entrepreneur. Let's start with the first one. Can you tell us about your innovation journey and the arc that you've gone through throughout your career?
Yeah. And because you complimented me on the conciseness of my articles, I'll do my best to kind of give you my journey toward and into innovation as concisely as I can. It weirdly enough begins, I have to say, kind of like I can draw a through line from my interest in college, which was working in the entertainment field, through my work in the international nonprofit development sector into my work as a management consultant. There we're getting warmer, if not hotter. And then now into what I'm doing through MindHatch. So there really is a lot of connective tissue between all the various careers I've had, even if on paper it seems kind of random. But I think, you know, I really came to innovation more concretely, you know, when I was working in international nonprofit development, I was working at an NGO in my first career after graduate school. And I was dissatisfied with that career choice pretty quickly. And I think for a lot of what I didn't know at the time were, in fact, kind of cultural reasons and kind of working in a place where like inertia kind of ruled the day rather than really seeking to understand problems and solve them, you know, for our beneficiaries. And so anyway, in that time, I became acquainted with social innovation and social entrepreneurship. And that's really what led me to want to get into consulting and to get some business experience. Originally, my hope was to get that business underpinning and then bring all those learnings back to the social change sector, which is where I was coming from. And then I started, you know, doing innovation work in a corporate environment and realized that I could scratch my itch for innovation and productive change in any sector. You know, I really enjoyed the corporate work as well. And so while I was in management consulting, that's where I started doing innovation and strategy work, as well as where I first got acquainted and an expert in design thinking.
That's great. A question that I wanted to ask before I ask a second question is, in your LinkedIn profile, you talk about design thinking, which we'll get to a little bit later. And then you said organizational improv. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between just regular improv and how you describe it as organizational improv?
Yeah, gosh, thank you so much for that question, because it's something that can often be taken for granted, I think. So I am an improv performer. That is where I first kind of became involved in improv, was through taking classes, performing with teams, and teaching and coaching myself. So I came to it as a performer, as like a theatrical art form first. And then when I began working in innovation, I started seeing very, very similar parallels. And in fact, when I was in management consulting at Deloitte, my colleagues caught wind of that I was doing improv after hours, you know, for fun. And it was they who came to me and said, "Hey, I've been reading in Harvard Business Review for years that, you know, improv can be really helpful to the business. Will you come do an improv session for my client team?" And I, of course, said yes, you know, and it was a wonderful surprise to kind of learn from my colleagues that this very serious hobby I was pursuing after hours had relevance, you know, to my day-to-day work and to their work as well. And so when I use the phrase organizational improv, you know, that's Mind Hatch's term for applying the principles, behaviors, mindsets, and skills behind improvisational theater and comedy, but applying those to the workplace. So that's kind of what we mean by that. Other people call it applied improv. Some people might call it corporate improv or, you know, any other variety of terms, but our kind of preferred term is organizational improv to kind of convey the difference between, you know, this is about application to your work and to your business and less so about, you know, being an improv performer on stage.
That's excellent. That's a great description. And I think at Mindhatch, that's one of the key things you're able to provide is that applied skill set that you couple with things like design thinking and probably some other innovation methodologies. So, and it sounds a lot like what Jay's doing right now, you know, working here at the Innovation Engine and then going off and doing improv classes and
and you see the connections so quickly, and I'm pretty early in that journey, haven't gotten on stage or anything yet, fingers crossed, not too far away, but
I'd do it.
You know, once I started doing some things at work and talking about with some of our innovation colleagues locally, I partnered with David Phillips of Fasterglass, who's been a great friend of the Innovation Engine and on the podcast a couple of times. And he said, "Why don't you bring this?" He was doing a not-for-profit retreat a couple of weeks ago. Let's test how this would work in a workshop. It was a board who had a lot of new members, so he wanted to get people engaged and collaborating pretty quickly. So I just did a little 45-minute workshop to help tee that up. And I got a second gig the next week out of it for a teacher, which was cool. But, you know, there's so many places to go with this discussion. But talk to us a little bit about how you fuse improv into design thinking.
Yeah, you know, so as I mentioned, when I was kind of first kind of revising my career into being one about innovation, it happened to coincide with when I started doing improv as well. And so I saw like all those parallels and like, you know, a lot of the mindsets and tenets were like virtually identical, you know. So from early on in my innovation career, I knew there was some there, you know, in terms of like some matchmaking and kind of compatibility, you know, between innovation and design thinking in particular, and improv. And so I kind of just tucked that thought, you know, behind my ear for a couple of years while I was still working at a management firm, a consulting firm. And then when I decided to found Mindhatch, it kind of became like almost like a no-brainer. You know, it was like, well, if I'm going to launch this business and this solo practice of doing this work, I have this skill. I've been doing improv sessions, you know, so why not add it to the portfolio? And then I was still kind of seeking a way to really merge the two. And I think, you know, to cut to the chase in terms of how I'm merging the two now, it happens in a couple different ways. You know, the primary way is when I'm doing design thinking sessions, be it, you know, capacity building training workshops for clients, or if I'm doing something that's a bit more kind of like in practicum, you know, using design thinking, I always find space to use improv, particularly in my training sessions, because I find that improv is really, really good at training you in the mindsets that are necessary to do good design thinking work. I personally am very passionate about doing innovation work, and especially design thinking innovation work, with integrity. It's a little too easy to think you can kind of plug and chug that process and like out comes the innovative result. But it really requires a lot of integrity and purpose at every step of the way to make sure you're, you know, doing things like getting good data and such, and making sure you're preoccupied with how to serve your customers. And so I find improv exercises to be a really great mindset primer, you know, for people who are learning design thinking for the first time or about to kind of start practicing design thinking in real life. So that's kind of the primary way where I kind of fuse the two disciplines that I really love and am expert in. And then I also have an offering that is, depending on the client, you know, geared towards design thinking neophytes or to actual designers who are living and breathing this every day. But it is like improv for design thinking, you know, to really using improv to enhance the skills and the behaviors and the mindsets that can help you, you know, achieve a better design thinking practice.
Yeah, that's great. And to add on to that, something I've learned from you, there's actually some research out there about improv increasing the level of creativity and brainstorming capacity. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I wish I had the data right at my fingertips. I know it appears in one of my articles. But yeah, there has been a lot of research done about improvisation across the spectrum. You know, there's been like MRIs done of like jazz musicians and what their brains look like when they are improvising jazz, you know, and it's just kind of like different. You know, I'm no neuroscientist, so I'm probably going to mess this up, but different kind of like lobes and zones of the brain being activated that otherwise are not activated, you know, when they're in this creative improv process. And then, you know, one of my articles, which is about, you know, using improv for brainstorming and ideation, references some research that shows exactly what you just said, doing a study in which people who basically improv comedians greatly outperformed experts, so-called experts in the field, when it came to coming up with both a quantity of ideas, but then also the quality of the ideas were better. So we're talking like non-experts, improv comedians outperforming people who are experts in their field, you know, and coming up with new and innovative solution ideas. And so, there's a lot of research out there supporting what we tend to kind of almost derogatorily refer to as soft skills. You know, I really wish I could like, you know, rebrand that phrase into something that doesn't have a counterpoint, like soft skills, hard skills, you know, because I think it does it a disservice. But there's a lot of research coming out that shows that creative practices like improv can really boost your ability to, you know, perform in workplace environments.
I'm right there with you and would be happy to brainstorm a different term, mm-hmm. because it's starting to drive me crazy that you have these soft skills like listening and playing well with others that you don't practice and teach those. You learn your technical skills. You can learn the five stages of design thinking and you can learn all the book things, but then the soft skills are really what's the hardest to deploy. And so,
yeah, the soft skills really are like how you do the work, right? The hard skills are the what of the work, and then the soft skills are the how. You know, and often all the good stuff is in the how, you know? And so actually just a week or so ago, I was either chatting with someone or who knows, maybe eavesdropping on someone, but I loved what this person said. She said, you know, they're not soft. She said soft skills are the hard skills, you know?
Yeah.
Meaning that they are harder, you know, to execute and harder to be good at. And so, you know, definitely this person was agreeing with me in that it deserves not only more respect, you know, those skills, but also more more care and development, because it's really important. It's in my mind, it's very easy to train someone in a hard skill, but the soft skills are like a little bit more ineffable, more intangible, and can take a longer time to kind of like shift someone's mindset and how they, you know, want to work with others, if they do at all.
Yeah.
Less quantifiable.
Yeah. Well, I imagine improv has been in the workplace now for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. A lot of large companies have used workshops and that sort of thing. Second City has a big business in that. But I imagine there's still a lot of organizations where there's some skepticism. How do you overcome that with businesses, or you're talking about what you do and maybe they're talking to you about design thinking and innovation, and then they're like, well, what's this improv thing? How do you overcome? Do you hit much resistance, and how do you overcome that?
Yeah, you know, I can absolutely speak to your question. And I think I'm fortunate enough that I think now MindHatch has been in existence long enough where if I'm talking to someone about design thinking or improv, period, they're probably already a little over the skepticism hump. You know, they're already becoming fellow travelers and already understand the value and so on. So I find myself these days, just by virtue of being in business longer, but then also the world's changing, you know, I find myself needing to do less of that persuasion than I used to. But I can definitely talk to you about how when I did have to do a lot more persuading, and even now, if I were in that position, you know, what I tend to see being really helpful, you know, in helping people get over their skepticism with the improv piece in particular. So the first piece that I found has been really helpful to me, just based on the clients that I'm working with, is I think a lot of organizations and companies who might be, you know, thinking about doing improv for the first time, they might have a couple of misconceptions. The first one might be that, oh, this is only good for team building. The second misconception might be, oh, but I don't want to like act or perform, or mm-hmm. I don't want my people to act or perform and that kind of thing. And so I feel like the way that I practice organizational improv is a little unique compared to a lot of other kind of corporate improv trainers, in that I don't make my, you know, client teams perform or act or be anyone other than themselves in that room. And it goes back to what I said earlier, you know, where it doesn't matter if you are a good improv performer at work. You know, that's what I do after hours as a performer. You know, what matters is, are you able to kind of be inspired by and be motivated to put into practice, you know, the behaviors and mindsets and skills that improv can impart. I find often when I talk a client down from the ledge by saying, oh, don't worry, there'll be no acting, there's usually this like huge sigh of relief. And so then I know they're along for the ride. So I think that conception has been put out there probably by like the decade or more of, you know, corporate improv training that has come before me, right? You know, like I don't make my clients do scenes, you know, unless they really want to. That's not the goal, right, of their learning for the most part. And then on that other misconception about, you know, I think improv has very sound connections to things like team building. And it certainly is wonderful to do that. But in my mind, that's just like the first level on the spectrum of, you know, the value that improv can provide. So, you know, at MindHatch, we certainly are very happy to do, you know, team building oriented improv sessions. You know, it's not uncommon for someone to reach out saying, oh my gosh, I'm so sick of doing happy hours with my team. I want to do something else that's still social and fun, you know, and socializing and fun are great, great outputs of an improv session. But mainly MindHatch's bread and butter is kind of like up the up the further end of the spectrum in my mind of like more skills development, you know, more application to the workplace, more kind of experimenting with and with embodying those behaviors and mindsets in the hope of like it changing the way that you work ultimately. And so improv can, I think, fire across all those cylinders on that spectrum. I'm really mixing my metaphors now. I apologize. But yeah, so I think that's a big way that I've been able to kind of persuade clients and get them to not be scared. Yeah.
Kanoor, you're talking about the mindsets that you're hoping to provide people in your design thinking, in your improv workshops. Can you talk to us about how you come in, you do these workshops? What training do you provide or what tips do you offer organizations to help them sustain the design thinking or improv skills that they've just acquired with you? How can they continue leveraging those skills in their work?
Yeah. You know, so the best hope of that kind of like occurring is you need to do this repeatedly, right? I often draw the parallel to like yoga. You know, like you wouldn't go take one yoga class and then declare yourself a yogi, right? Or like a guru of yoga. Improv is similar. You know, it is like a behavior, a practice, you know, and so you need to do it repeatedly. So I think the clients that are bound to have the most success in kind of sustaining it are the ones who are doing not just one kind of 2-hour session, but they're really kind of committing to being like, okay, I want my people to do this once every 2 weeks or once a month or some type of regularity like that. I think in addition, another great way to kind of sustain beyond is to have like either mutual accountability or accountability to kind of a coach/advisor who is helping you identify those concrete opportunities in your day-to-day when you can practice what you've learned, you know, and then coming back and chatting about how did it go, right? And so I think you can definitely, as it goes with any kind of professional development experience, you know, you can kind of do all the training that you want, but it's not really going to come to life unless you like operationalize it, right? And you need to kind of give people both the opportunity to put it into action, but then also frankly, like the safety, you know, of, hey, yeah, go try it out. And even if it doesn't work, good on you for trying, right? Yeah. Try it again next time. So I think there's a lot of those types of, you know, systems and also cultural factors you can put into place to encourage sustainability afterward.
Yeah. So our team has kind of dipped its toe into improvising a bit. After I came back from Second City, I did a lunch and learn on the experience, and we did a couple of exercises. And then a few weeks ago, we started in our Monday morning huddles, where we kind of start the week together. We got a group of 10 people, started doing some basic exercises just for like 5 minutes at the beginning of each one. And so trying to reinforce those behaviors on a weekly basis, I've focused a lot on yes and listening, just exercises that really make people listen. And we talk about it after each time, but I've kind of committed to do this on a weekly basis, and I want to keep it fresh. And I'm trying to build each week. You know, you talked about not having people make scenes. Any advice on how you go deeper and accelerate learning over time with people?
Over time, it's really interesting, you know, because in terms of like the learning of at an awareness and exposure level of a lot of the tenets of improv, I don't think just the outright learning of that takes too long, right? But it is much more like the making it a part of yourself, right? And having it just be who you are and how you work. I think that is what you know takes the time, as it would with any of us. You know, it's why for my performing teams, we still rehearse all the time, you know, because you're constantly trying to just make it a part of who you are. And so I think in terms of the, you know, the ongoing learning, I think what you're doing is spot on. Like you're identifying those moments of intervention, however small, those moments of opportunity, however small, and you're imbuing them with, you know, things you learn from improv. And I think it's great. Like, I think the listening piece and the yes and piece are wonderful kind of touch points for improv. And the way I kind of look at, you know, sessions or meetings or workshops is, you know, you can use improv to kind of cognitively prime people for the behavior you want them to exhibit in the room, right? So you're using yes and listening probably means you want people to, well, certainly listen well, but then also on the yes and piece to think expansively, right? And to be generative rather than evaluative of what's coming up, you know, and you can definitely target interventions using improv kind of just based on how you need people to show up in the room. You know, say you need people to just focus, right? You can do some activities that are all about focusing, right? If you need people to be very spontaneous, you can do some priming activities about spontaneity. You know, so there's a lot of behaviors, you know, in that deep, deep well of improv that you can kind of target and prime people for, sometimes even without even letting them know that they're doing improv.
Oh,
that's awesome. And you started to go there, but our team facilitates a lot of design sessions. What are some of the improv exercises or activities that you found to be particularly effective for design sessions?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'd be happy to share with you. So I want to try to go in order of the design thinking process that I take people through. So, I think one that I'm very fond of, in part because it's so fast, but then so, I think, provocative. When I'm teaching design thinking, you know, I tend to subscribe to the 5-step Stanford D School articulation of design thinking. I just like the way it's laid out for a kind of first time learners and how it's articulated. So the first step or phase is empathy. So kind of really understanding your users, your customers, you know, conducting kind of ethnographic like field research with them to really understand their wants and their needs and their desires. So before I'm getting workshop participants to kind of do that activity, I'll have them do a little improv activity. It's so simple. You know, I'll have them basically just get into pairs and I'll have them take turns sharing with each other a story of theirs. And that story, usually the prompt I give is share with your partner your either your best customer service experience ever or your worst customer experience ever. So kind of like two extremes. And then once one person is done sharing their story, best or worst, their partner needs to kind of reflect back to them and say, based on what I just heard you say, I think blank is important to you. So it kind of gets people to like be listening harder. It gets people to start doing that extrapolation and inference that we really need to do, you know, at that stage of a design thinking process. And it's a really good reflection of, you know, rarely does a customer tell you what they want or tell you what is important and meaningful to them. You know, it's up to you to kind of listen and decipher and like be a detective about it. So that's one that I always do. And then on the kind of cognitively priming for the ideation step in design thinking, I tend to choose, and Jay, you might be familiar with this. It's known by a couple different names, but I do an exercise called Squirrel Nut Tree, which is essentially a physical version of yes anding, but using your bodies. So I find that's helpful to kind of show people a different, more physical mode of thinking and being additive in their thinking right before going into an ideation phase.
Oh, have you trained me in that offline? I don't know that one.
I love that, the whole concept, as you were mentioning before, of cognitively priming people for either the divergent or convergent thinking at the various steps of the design thinking process. I think that's such a smart thing to do. That's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so much of it is muscle memory or like sense memory even. And so I think that's why I like to include some mindset work, you know, when I'm delivering those sessions, because I just think it's very important. Yeah.
So Knorr, we're a good bit through the podcast now. What do you think about cognitively priming Ben for some creativity?
Oh, my. Well, should we prime him or just force him into it? What do you think?
We'll just throw him into the pool.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can't do an episode on improv without actually doing some improv.
Right. You're right. So Knorr's got a game that you can actually download on her website. I think it's great. It's called Five Things. Do you want to do the honors? You want me to do it, Knorr?
Oh, Jay, please. You're a fellow improv compatriot, so please go ahead.
Okay. So, Ben, this is something we really want rapid fire thinking from you. So we want you to think about, give us five names of a fictional roller coaster.
King Cobra.
One.
Mountaintop.
Two.
Speed Demon.
Three.
Freaky Fast.
Four.
And Velocity Venom.
These are five things. All right. Way to go, but that was nice and fast.
I don't know why I was on it.
I really like that.
I don't know what the alliteration thing was about, but somehow that was helpful.
Well, you have been to an amusement park lately. Yes, so, you know, I thought that would be comfortable for you.
That was good. was that the speed that is desired?
So. You know, that was pretty fast, I have to say. Yeah, I mean, lots of people, myself probably included, are guilty of filler in between. It's like or before saying the next one, and you were pretty clean.
Wow.
So the rate was pretty good. Yeah, like Jay said, the intention of that game is to kind of encourage tip of the tongue, off the cuff, no self censoring. You know, kind of contributions. Yeah, but then also kind of like, as you mentioned, you were doing alliteration a little bit. And often what you find when people are doing this exercise is that they start to riff on their own ideas that came right before, which is great. You can always riff. You can always be your own source of inspiration, right? And so there literally are no wrong ways to play this game, or no wrong responses, rather, to the prompts. Yeah.
So again, everyone go to the MindHatch website. There's lots of other fun suggestions to kind of add creativity to your sessions.
Yeah, that's great. And that was, to our listeners, I did not know what the prompt was. That was fully.
And probably no edits either. So you were quick.
Yeah, well done.
Well, I know we're probably coming up against time, Ben, but there is one question I had. You know, one of the articles you've got that I think is fascinating is about how to avoid hiring your company's next brilliant jerk. And it kind of riffs, I think, a little bit off of Reed Hastings' philosophy, zero tolerance policy. You talk about building improv technique into the hiring process without, you know, giving away your secret sauce or anything. Can you talk a little bit about how do you do that?
Yeah. So this is definitely born of, you know, me having worked in like large and small organizations and, you know, sometimes either the culture not being off or, sorry, the culture being a mismatch for like the work we're trying to do, or, you know, someone being hired in and not being the right fit, you know, for the existing culture. And I started to do a little bit of research. I actually talked to the some, you know, hiring managers and talent managers and recruiters, and just talked to them about, you know, like what gets in the way of you like hiring the right people. And, you know, when you happen to be disappointed or surprised in a bad way about someone you thought was perfect, you know, during the interview process, what tends to be like the reason, right? And it was kind of a matching up of my own gut instinct with also what I learned from these people that I talked to, which is that the existing and usual hiring process isn't really good at assessing people's like values and soft skills, frankly. Back to that, that phrase again, they're soft skills. You know, you can, you know, what I heard from hiring managers and talent folks was that, you know, sometimes like they'd send someone for their final round interview and they're talking to like the VP of something. And, you know, the VP comes back and he or she says, oh, thumbs up, hire that guy, you know, and then maybe, you know, 5 months later, this person is a wreck, like not a good addition to the team. And then, you know, the hiring person says that, you know, they find out that in that interview, that final interview, they just discover that they like belong to the same frat or like the same baseball team or something like that, that is very much about affinity, but not about the work, right? And so you get to have this bias process, but then also hiring people in your own image, you know, and you can, that's how you get kind of more homogenous kind of like teams working together. So yeah, so there are a lot of like pitfalls to the existing kind of hiring practices that are being used. And in addition to those pitfalls, like no real way to assess things like how do people confront obstacles? How do they work with people? When push comes to shove, are they just going to try to make themselves look good rather than their colleagues look good? You know, all of those intangible things that currently our hiring practices don't really have a good, consistent way of evaluating, you know, before giving someone an offer letter. And so I really think because improv is like trained so much in those soft skills, I just thought that this could be a really good like merging together of, again, two disciplines, you know, and using improv in the hiring practice to complement, not replace, but to complement existing processes. So you also get into the pitfall of, you know, job seekers and young people. Gosh, I was probably one of them. We're very savvy. You know, you can kind of like play the game of an interview. You can memorize how you would answer questions to behavioral or answer behavioral questions, right? But if you put someone through like a group-based improv session, they have nowhere to hide, right? They can only be themselves, you know, in that moment. They can't prepare, you know, so you kind of stand a better chance of seeing their true colors, you know, if you're putting them through something like that. Not through the ringer, so to speak. You still want it to be enjoyable and realistic, but you just get to kind of see how they react in the face of obstacles, right? Or, you know, if something's thrown at them, how do they respond? Yeah.
Are they doing it with other candidates, or are they just doing it with a group with the hiring company?
Yeah, you know, so as Jay, I'm sure you know, improv is not competitive. There's no reason for it to be competitive. So I really view it as something that can happen. You could have people who are applying for totally different positions in the same group, right? Who are doing improv together. Or you can have people who are vying for the same position in the same room. But really, it's not like a comparative kind of assessment. It's much more about that individual, right? Yeah. So I think it can work well, you know, both ways. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Very cool. Well, Kinnor, maybe to conclude, what advice would you give someone who's intrigued but nervous about the idea about doing improv? You know, this is something that you do as a hobby and professionally, but what advice would you provide for someone whose curiosity has been piqued?
If their curiosity has been piqued about performing, or their curiosity has been piqued about, you know, bringing it to their workplace?
I'd say both.
Both? Okay. Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Okay. So, on the performance side, I have so many ways to evangelize improv. So I'm going to try to keep it brief. But on the performance side, I would just say you can't find like a better community than fellow improvisers. I relocated to Seattle 2 years ago. My primary improv communities were in Washington, D.C. and New York City. But I knew if I just find like five improvisers, I'm going to be great, you know, like, because you can go to any town, and if you find the improv community, you're going to find good, solid, generous people. So I'd say that's a really good selling point for improv. But also, like, from my personal experience, and no need to get too lengthy with it, but I definitely had like a coulda, shoulda, woulda moment when I was in college when it came to performing improv, and I didn't do it, and I had so much regret. And then 8 years after that, I decided to get the monkey off my back and just do it. And so I'm like living proof of like, you know, don't have the regret. If you have any interest, just do it, try it out, learn for yourself if it's for you or not. There's like very, very little downside to giving it a try, and no one has to know, right? So if I can just pass on my own hard-earned wisdom of, don't live 8 years with regret before doing something you were curious about. Just don't do that. Go out and do it now, and get a taste of it for yourself. Do that research. Get that information to make an informed decision. And then on the workplace side, for someone who's curious about it, you know, I think You know, another great thing about improv in the workplace is that, you know, at least the way I hope, you know, my clients would think of MindTouch, it's a pretty low barrier to kind of getting it to happen. You just need like an empty conference room, a few chairs, you know, no tables, no materials or supplies are needed. You know, you generally set something up with like 2 weeks notice. So in terms of like your own labor, the lifts can be pretty light, you know, so yeah. It's not like you have to deal with like licensing programming, you know, for a year's worth or something like that. You know, you can definitely dip your toe in like a low risk way, I think, even in the workplace as well. But then, you know, also I think there's nothing really quite like improv in terms of approach. So certainly there's a lot of other methodologies out there to learn and acquire soft skills for sure. But there's nothing quite like improv in terms of that methodology. So I would just say, you know, embrace experimentation and just, you know, let your curiosity lead you to think, wow, what if we learned about this in an experiential way, you know, rather than listening to someone talk in front of a PowerPoint for a few hours. I think matching the methodology and the approach to what you want to have learned can be really valuable.
Sounds like good advice. We say often we steal a phrase from IDEO Futures: don't get ready, get started.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you, Kinnor, for this lively and enlightening interview. We so appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much. Again, it was a real privilege to be asked and to be able to do this.
Well, dear listeners, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and share it with your network. And please share with us some feedback on LinkedIn or Twitter using the hashtag Innovation Engine. And of course, feedback in the form of ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts is always welcome. Thanks again, and we will see you at the base of the next Innovation Mountain.
Innovation Mountain. Oh, my goodness.